Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
My new book, Diary of a Psychosis, is out. It's the most lively, devastating baseball bat to the throat takedown of what the public health establishment did in 2020 and beyond that you can imagine. It's my first book in 9 years, and you're going to love it. Check it out at diaryofcovid.com. And if you've already bought it, make sure also to visit diaryofcovid.com so you can claim your free bonuses, including my free companion volume, Collateral Damage, a collection of stories from real people who suffered under the restrictions. They weren't allowed to tell their stories at the time, but every one of them told me, "We just want to be heard." Check it all out at diaryofcovid.com. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 2452. I am joined today by the great Mark Skousen, who has been hosting Freedom Fest in Las Vegas for how many years is it now, Mark?
Well, that's a good question. It started in 2007, so minus 24.
I guess 17 years. And I mean, I know you've had them in a couple of other places because of COVID, but we're back in Vegas for 2024. I'm going to be there. We'll talk about that in a little while. But you are also the publisher of Forecasts and Strategies, which is a financial investment newsletter that you've been publishing since, what, 1980?
Since the greatest president of the 20th century was elected.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So that means, what, 1924? I'm just kidding.
Yes, you would say that, wouldn't you?
I mean, you look great, Mark.
For Calvin a guy, Coolidge, right.
Guy who's been publishing since 1924, you look fantastic. But also, in addition to all that, you've written, even more books than I have, and you're a professor out at Chapman University, so you keep busy.
I was the first appointed the Doty Spoglie Chair of Free Enterprise at Chapman, so an adjunct does good, because I was always an adjunct before that, when I taught at Columbia or at Rollins or at Mercy or what have you, but now I have a chair, so I expect the proper respect that comes with that.
Okay.
I don't want you to throw any chairs.
All right, look, we're going to talk today about something that we are commemorating this year in 2024. 50 years ago, F.A. Hayek co-won the Nobel Prize in 1974. And you're very good with anniversaries, Mark. I had not even thought about this. I haven't done that many really in-depth economics episodes in a while. And I can't neglect that segment of the audience, and we all need this kind of knowledge. But I'm going to roll the dice here and hope that the audience will stick with me as I say something completely off the wall and not relevant at all to this conversation.
Wouldn't be the first time.
The first time. There's that old zinger from Mark Skousen. That's where the spice in our friendship comes from, is remarks like that. So I was telling Mark before we went on about, I don't know, we were talking some mathematical thing.
Prime numbers.
We both like numbers. Yeah, prime numbers. Yeah. And I asked him if he was familiar with the Monty Hall problem, and he was not. So I want to tell him about it, and I want everybody to know about it. And those of you who have heard of it but don't understand it, this is your lucky day. So some of you out there, the oldsters, will remember Monty Hall as the host of Let's Make a Deal. Now, Wayne Brady has hosted a more recent iteration of the show, but the principle is the same. At the end of the show, I think it's the top winner gets a chance to risk it all on one of three possible doors. One door has the grand prize behind it. Another door has like a middling prize, but you'd rather have the grand prize. And the third door has like a goat. Like you do not want that third door. So here's the Monty Hall problem. And it is absolutely counterintuitive, but I'm going to explain why it isn't. So Mark, the way it goes is this. Suppose I choose door number three. What Monty will always do before revealing the door with the grand prize, he'll never open my door first. He'll say, well, let's see what would have happened if you had chosen door number two. He opens door number two, and there's that middling prize. And I say, oh, okay, well, that's fair enough. So the question now is, now that he's opened door number two, should I switch my vote? And instead of selecting door number three, should I now move to door number one? Should I change? Because he'll ask me, would you like to change, or do you want to stick with your original statement that you want door number three? It turns out, Mark, that you do better if you switch there. And it doesn't seem that it should make any difference. And of course, we're all stubborn. No, I'm going to stick with my original vote. But here's how we can understand why, in that situation, it makes perfect sense for you to actually change your mind. And the reason is this. Imagine that there are not three doors, but a million. And you choose, let's say, door number two out of a million. Now, you know in your heart, with a million doors, you basically have no chance of winning. Like, you know that. It's probably like not lottery. Behind door number two. So now imagine Monty opens every single door except door number two and except door number 898,117. Now, which door probably has the grand prize? Probably not yours, unless you got it on a one in a million chance. It's probably door 898,117. So if he says, do you want to switch? You better believe I'm switching. So with only three doors, it's the same principle on a smaller scale. Isn't that extraordinary to me?
Yeah, and you explain it by going to the extreme example, which is really helpful. So, but doesn't Monty Hall, wasn't he famous also for saying, now listen, I'll give you, and he says, I'll pay you $1,000. You can take that now instead of choosing that particular.
Oh, he would do things like that, yes. And you never know what the right thing to do is. There you're on your own.
Yeah, well, no, you're guaranteed $1,000
or
whatever.
Yeah, but what if I could have won?
And it definitely pays to go for the $1,000, right? A bird in the hand.
You know it'll pay out. That's true. Is that how you would play if you were on Let's Make a Deal?
Yeah.
You're a bird in the hand guy.
Let's Make a Deal. And they're always offering these cash rewards and it keeps going up. And I think that's a suggestion you should take it.
That's interesting. Okay, and I would be in the audience saying, no, Mark, go for it.
Well, yeah, because who cares? It's taxable anyway, so you don't want the prize.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, at least with the cash, I can pay some of it out, and it's easy. I don't have to liquidate it.
See, but this is the thing. This demonstrates that both you and me, we sit around watching Let's Make a Deal and The Price is Right during the day instead of working.
Well, but my hard work in the past now allows me to be a lazy bum if I choose to. So let's talk now about something a little bit more productive, and that is our friend F.A. Hayek, whom I feel certain, I think I've seen a photo of you with him.
That's correct. I met him twice and interviewed him for 3 hours in 1985 at his chalet in the Austrian Alps with Gary North. We interviewed him for 3 hours, and he was just a delight to talk to about everything under the sun, all of his books and all of his works and stuff like that. It's included in this book called Hayek on Hayek. We don't get any attribution for some reason, but that is the basis of half the book. And it was really fun. But I tell you, at the end, his wife Elaine came running out and screaming at us saying, get out, you have ruined his life. He won't be able to do any research for weeks at a time. You've taken too much time. Get out, get out. I mean, it was just embarrassing.
Oh my gosh, that is extraordinary. Wow.
Yeah, she was not well liked by hardly anybody except Hayek. That was his second wife. And I talked to his Lawrence Hayek, his son, who was a medical doctor. And he said, yeah, she was not very well liked by the family. But Hayek was very happy with her as a second wife. So I was so pleased to have this interview. And one of the things that was really important about this interview was I had been working on my book, The Structure of Production, which introduces gross output and the whole idea that we need to return to the structure of production, this Austrian macroeconomics, which has largely been abandoned by monetarists and the Keynesians and so on, who are all into macro aggregates, if you will. And Hayek was very pleased that I was resurrecting Hayek's triangles. So I was just delighted. He really encouraged me to finish my book, which was published in 1990, called The Structure of Production, published by NYU Press.
Well, we're going to dig into that in just a minute, because I feel like if somebody wants to get a good understanding of, like, let's say, Hayekian capital theory and what Hayek was saying in his works pre and I guess also during World War II, I would actually not direct them initially to Hayek's own works, which are, I think, very difficult works. I think your book, The Structure of Production, which is an academic book, to be sure, it's not, you know, it's not written for the average Joe, but it is written for the intelligent layman. The intelligent layman who's grounded in Austrian economics can profit very much from that book of yours. And it's interesting, you've published a variety of books for different audiences. So you have introductory books for people who don't know anything about investing. You have more advanced books. You have histories of thought. You have so many different things for so many different audiences. That's an academic book. That is not a book that a whole lot of people come up to you and say, would you please autograph my copy of The Structured Production? But you don't remember this, but when I first met you back around 2010 or something at Freedom Fest or 2009 or something, I brought my copy of The Structured Production, which is around here somewhere, signed by you. From that point on, we had a very nice friendship because I think you realized, okay, this is not your casual Skousen reader.
Well, actually, I guess the question is, have you read that book? Have you underlined it?
I absolutely have. I had already read it before I brought it. Yeah, you know, it's it's a very, very helpful book. So we're going to explain, again, for the layman, what's actually in there. But let's first clarify that when Hayek won that Nobel Prize in the 70s, he was winning it not for the works that people are most familiar with today. They're most familiar with, it's not a strictly economic work, The Road to Serfdom or The Constitution of Liberty or Law, Legislation, Liberty. It wasn't any of that. It was the work he did on capital theory and business cycles. And so that's what we want to talk about.
That's the amazing thing, Tom, about this is he was listed. Why did he win the Nobel Prize? It's because of his Austrian theory of the business cycle. They specifically mentioned business cycles in his capital theory. So it really is prices and production and so forth. And there's no mention whatsoever of The Road to Serfdom, which is his most popular book and became a best-selling book in the United States and the UK. And actually got Winston Churchill into trouble because he got up and said, well, this is all totalitarianism. This is The Road to Serfdom. If you don't vote for me and you vote for Attlee and the socialists, and it cost him the election because he's basically arguing a road to serfdom. If you adopt the Attlee Labor Party approach, then you're going to end up as socialists and a totalitarian regime with no free speech or anything like that. And people felt that that was unfair to Attlee and so forth. And one of the reasons he lost the election, they say, after World War II.
Well, be that as it may, and do you remember Yuri Maltsev? You must have met him.
Yeah, he passed away last year, right? I think we're dedicating a room to him at Freedom Fest.
Oh, terrific. Tremendous. Yeah, what a great guy he was. So he's been on this show a couple of times. He was one of the last Soviet defectors to the U.S. and a very, very interesting guy. And one day, Glenn Beck, for some reason, had become fascinated by The Road to Serfdom. And I was on his radar because I'd written Meltdown. And so I was contacted. Would you like to come do a show? This was back when he was on Fox still. Would you like to do a show, a whole hour on The Road to Serfdom? I said, would I? Of course. And they said, well, do you have anybody else in mind who might want to do it? And I said, Yuri Maltsev would be perfect because when he was studying at Moscow State University, he had to go to a special room to read The Road to Serfdom, you know, where they had all the prohibited books or something, and swear that he would never disclose the contents, that he was reading it for scholarly purposes and all that. And so they loved him, as you could imagine. They absolutely loved him. So The Road to Serfdom has yielded me some very fond memories, but as you say, it doesn't figure into the winning of the prize. So I want to... Go ahead.
And, you know, that's because it's really more political than economic. But one thing I do point out that a lot of people don't realize is that Hayek, even after he won the Nobel Prize, was a pessimist his entire life. And if you even read the introduction to new editions that he wrote, preface to a new edition, he would talk about how things are headed toward the road to serfdom and toward totalitarianism and socialism. Even after Reagan and Thatcher adored him and pulled up his book and said, this road to serfdom is really good. And by the way, one of the reasons why this book was banned in the Soviet Union was chapter 10. Chapter 10 is the most famous chapter in this book. And do you know what the title of that chapter is?
I thought chapter 9
was... I'm testing you.
I thought chapter 9 was Why the Worst Get on Top. Is it chapter 10?
Oh, okay. I thought it was chapter 10.
But I could be wrong. Well, somebody can settle this for us. But is that the chapter you had in mind?
I've got the copy of the book right here. I can look very quickly at what the chapter is.
We need to know, Mark. We need to know.
Yes, we must know. So chapter 10, it's chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top.
Okay.
He's writing this in 1944. So who are the people that are on top? Well,
right.
It's Stalin, it's Adolf Hitler, it's Mussolini, And of course, it's FDR, and Hayek didn't think much of FDR either. And of course, that's the thing. How do you revise that chapter when Thatcher and Reagan get on top? Are they the worst? Obviously not. So I think that that is his most controversial chapter. And I don't agree with it. I think it depends on the times, of the spirit of the times. And we've had actually a road to freedom more than a road to serfdom since World War II, don't you think?
Some things are better. I mean, obviously, the idea of a centrally planned economy is more or less exploded. Like even the left doesn't really advocate that. They've sort of come to terms with market mechanisms and stuff. But at the same time, I mean, and by the way, I would much rather be alive in 2024 than I would in 1942 or 1948 for that matter. But I mean, with the COVID stuff but at the same time, you can also talk about the censorship and the suppression of dissident voices. But the fact is, if we're being fair, we have to also acknowledge that on balance, there's still way more space for dissident voices, even with all the big tech nonsense. I mean, look at me. I mean, this is evidence of it. I'm able to have a show that in principle, anyone on earth could be listening to. Anybody on earth, anywhere with an internet connection can hear what you and I are saying. And so I think sometimes we get so caught up in the negative that we don't stop to realize, and it's not to exonerate any of the bad people, the Joe Bidens of the world, but it is to say, let's be realistic about our situation. There are trends that I don't like. There are people organized against me who I think are up to no good, who I think are going to use climate change as an excuse to do a lot of nasty things. But for a change, I can hear what other people other than the three television networks think about it. I mean, so, you know, I mean, I
and
like
you know,
that.
The thing is, one of the big surprises is the Economic Freedom Index that is done on a world basis instead of just the U.S. The U.S. has been in decline in the Fraser Institute's Economic Freedom Index, which I think is a model of the Adam Smith system of natural liberty. And it's a beautiful way to empirically show what is actually happening around the world. And actually, the Economic Freedom Index, up until the pandemic, the world index was rising because of all the freedom that was being developed in other parts of the world, not particularly the U.S. But I would agree with you, we tend to be U.S.-centric, and we are seeing a decline in economic freedom, no question about that, as a result of 2008 financial crisis, as a result of the COVID lockdown. Those are negative. So I would agree with you. We are in decline culturally. In fact, our theme for Freedom Fest this next year is, are we entering a brave new world and of cultural decline and economic decline and so forth. So that fits in with what you're saying, Tom.
Hey folks, quick message from Virtual Storefronts. If you own a local business and you know you should probably be online, but you have no idea where to start and you're sure you can't afford it, then Virtual Storefronts is for you. They help local businesses get online faster and quicker than ever before, and they focus on getting local results in the search engines. You just set it and forget it. You set up keywords that match items you sell, and the Virtual Storefronts backend handles the rest. No maintenance or upkeep required. So you name it, restaurants, boutiques, salons, farmers markets, food trucks, art galleries, gift shops, event services, lawyers, insurance agents, cleaning, landscaping, whatever you can dream up, any locally owned, non-major franchise that is 12 or fewer locations, business that maintains regular hours and serves the public in a local area is qualified to create, maintain, and communicate with the public with a storefront at virtualstorefronts.com. Absolutely fantastic. Check it out. Get all the details at virtualstorefronts.co. That's virtualstorefronts.co. Well, let's go into, the material that Hayek was honored for. And I want to make sure and explain these terms because, you know, the structure of production could mean anything. I want the audience of the show to know what that means. And the thing is, when you describe what the Austrians have in mind with the structure of production, if you describe it to anybody other than a Keynesian or a monetarist, it sounds like just common sense. Like you almost can't understand why we're even talking about this. Of course, that's how production is set up. How else would it be set up? It might not even be obvious why this matters or how it fits into the business cycle or how it can get disrupted and what the results of that disruption might be. So can you explain what would be, maybe even give an example of a consumer good and the various stages of production it goes through.
Yeah. And today we've heard so much about the supply chain. And what a lot of people don't realize is that when we talk about GDP, gross domestic product, which is supposed to be the indicator of what's happening in the economy, that measures only final output. So that means the books that you wrote, that you and I have written, but it doesn't include the paper that was part of the book, doesn't include all the work and effort. A lot of people don't realize how big the supply chain is, the stages of production prior to the final use. You go into the grocery store, you see all the goods on the shelf, but you realize that behind the shelves is the back room where the inventories are. In the back, and look at Amazon, you see all the products that they have ready to ship. Well, those are products that were made at various places all around the world. You take the cell phone itself is made in 39 different countries, and the final product is finally put together in China. But meanwhile, there's all these elements of the supply chain that cost and require a lot of work and capital and investment and workers. And in fact, do you know that 80% of workers are in the supply chain mode? Only 20% work at retail. So it's a very big sector. And one of the things that the new measure that has come out, which is interesting because Hayek's connected to this, is the gross output statistic, GO, that the federal government adopted in 2018. Much to my surprise, I advocated it in my book, The Structure of Production, back in 1990. And here it is 24 years later that it is finally adopted by the government. And what is GO? GO is just GDP plus the supply chain. So all the stages of production are now included in GO. And GO is the supply chain is bigger than GDP itself. So it's really a fascinating field that has developed to see that it actually renewed my faith in the government, because the government is really ahead of the rest of the economics profession, which is still struggling to understand gross output and all this measurement of the stages of production. And I explain it in my textbook, Economic Logic, and I give lectures on this, and I just show a simple four-stage model of the economy, with the resource stage as the first stage, mining and that sort of thing. Second stage is the production stage, and the third stage is distribution. Once you produce the product, it has to be distributed to the retail outlets. It's like an automobile that starts off as iron ore and steel and all the thousands of other products, plastics and so on, that are put together at various stages of production. And your final output, your GDP statistic, is the automobile that you purchased or the books that you bought or the clothing that you wear or the glasses or the hats, your shoes, the entertainment, all of that goes through stages of production.
Right. So if we're going to have one big number that's supposed to tell us something about the economy, the trouble with this GDP number is that it's telling us about only one aspect of things. It's leaving out all these businesses who do not cater to the consumer, all these areas of human endeavor, the collective result of which is the consumer good at the end, but they're all doing things too, and they're just left out of the picture. And the result of that is that you get Keynesians then emphasizing the importance of the consumer and that consumer spending is everything. But consumer spending isn't, it's only everything if you define the number that way. You know, like if you define it, it's just going to be the end result for the consumer, we're just going to add those up, then yeah, I guess consumer spending looks like the central thing.
Yeah, and you see this all the time in the media. Well, what is retail spending? What is consumer spending doing? And of course, it's not doing much. It actually doesn't fluctuate. It's called a business cycle because it's business. It's the supply chain business, B2B spending. Now, that's what's really volatile. I should tell you that one of the reasons why this is a problem and Keynesian economics and GDP dominates instead of gross output, it's largely because Hayek, in his book Prices and Production, which came out in 1931 based on some lectures in London, that's where he introduced Hayek's triangles. and the stages of production is triangles because you add value as you move along the production stage. We're able to talk about this without, normally I have graphs and charts and show people this sort of thing. But what I'm saying is Hayek never did any empirical work, even though he in the 20s, he worked with the National Bureau of Economic Research in the United States, but he never did any empirical work. And this is one thing why I think Friedman and the Chicago School has made a great advance is that they emphasize, well, let's test your model with empirical studies and look at the data. And so what I have done and what the federal government has done is that we're putting real numbers to Hayek's triangles. But the reason I think we need to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Hayek winning the Nobel Prize is because he was the one who created this model, the stages of production, what are called Hayek's triangles, and the federal government is now measuring it. This is worth celebrating. I mean, this is the most important advance in Austrian macroeconomics since Hayek won the Nobel Prize. And that's why I think it's important to celebrate it. And I am disappointed that this is fact. Tom, I'm really delighted that we're talking about this because this is the first event where we're celebrating the 50th anniversary. And a lot of people haven't considered the incredible advance that has been made with the federal government, the BEA, now measuring gross output, which is Hayek's model.
The different stages of production you're talking about, they're temporal in that one stage comes before the other. And at the end, you're at the finished consumer good. So the farthest away, and maybe you would consider this in the resources stage, would be there isn't even a product yet. We're doing research and development. We're looking into potential products that people might want, or we're trying to figure out how to create them, how to bring them to market. Now that is very far. That means that the finished consumer good will be very far in the future. And then after that, you go through the various stages. And then within the stages, there are stages. So like the quote production stage, well, this good could be passed from one firm to another. Then it goes to distribution, which involves transportation, that could also involve marketing and advertising. There's so much that goes into all this. And so the question then is, as we look at that model you've described, that you begin with, you know, mining or, as you say, something very, very fundamental, and then you move through these various stages until you finish the product, in effect, why is that relevant? I mean, that seems obvious. Who would deny that? And what are the consequences of denying that?
Yeah, so energy would be a really good example. You asked for an example. So you talk about oil and gas out of the ground, the production process, the exploration, and the drilling of oil and gas. So that's your first stage. And then your second stage goes to the actual production of the oil and gas out of the ground, and then it's transported to a refinery, and then the refinery then turns it into various different kinds of oil and gas products, one of which is gasoline. And then the final stage is it gets to the gasoline station and you pump it out of there. So here's the two things that I think are really vital to understanding why this is important and why we need to measure all stages of production. The first one is you mentioned consumption being the biggest sector in the economy. Well, that's according to GDP statistics. The final use is 70% consumption. But if you measure all of the spent expenditures at all the four stages of production, consumption now drops to 1/3 of the economy. And 2/3 of the economy is business B2B spending, which is much more volatile. So if you want to look at what's happening in the economy, you've got to look at all the stages of production and not just the final stage. The other difference is that gross output is a better statistic measuring what's totally happening in the economy. And I'll give you an example. In 2022, there were two quarters where real GDP declined, and that's their definition of a recession. But GO never declined. The supply chain continued to grow in 2022 as it was trying to recover from the supply chain shortages that were going on. So GO is a better measure of what's happening in the economy, and it's much more volatile than GDP. For example, during the 2008 financial crisis, real GDP fell 2%. Now, does that in any way indicate how bad the recession was in 2008, the financial crisis, where Ben Bernanke said within a week, 12 out of the 13 biggest financial institutions were close to going bankrupt. So that indicates how bad things were. But if you look at GO, you look at the supply chain, it fell by double digits during 2008, 2009. So it dropped like a rock. So that's where the recession was. That's where the problem was. That's where the layoffs were taking place. Wasn't in retail, wasn't in consumer spending, which is relatively steady during the business cycle. So those are the two reasons why I think gross output is one that we need to look at. By the way, people can go to grossoutput.com. It's a website I've created where I have my quarterly press releases when GO is released, and people can see what's actually really happening in the economy, including what's happening in the intermediate or supply side chain.
Let's take a minute, as I said I was going to do in the middle of the conversation. Let's pause for a minute and say a little something about Freedom Fest itself, because I'm going to be there. You've kindly invited me and given me a day, as it were. And so I'll be speaking and putting some panels together and stuff like that. So it's a great event. As I said, I've probably been there at least twice. In fact, I met our friend Gene Epstein there at a debate that you organized on the Federal Reserve. I met him 5 minutes before we were set to be debate partners. So that was rather interesting. And that's been a nice friendship ever since then. But it's really, I've gotten to know some really wonderful people and learned a lot from being out there. And it's always fun to be in Las Vegas. There's so much to do.
You know, Freedom Fest, when I first created Freedom Fest, my idea, and this was in 2007, and we are a for-profit event. So we focus on our customer is our attendees. And so it's not our donors, like nonprofits and so on. And I think that's one reason we've been so successful. But my idea is that once a year, we all live busy lives, and can we all come together to learn from each other, to network and socialize and celebrate liberty? Because I think we've been losing this battle we've been talking about, that, you know, Hayek's pessimism, if you will. But there are solutions. We are making a difference. And we attract several thousand people every year. And it's a big conference, and it is a lot of fun because it's not just politics. It's not just finance. It's not just economics. It's healthy living. It's philosophy. It's history. It's science and technology. We always have a big name speaker. We have several big name speakers this year. But in the past, we've had William Shatner. We've had George Foreman. We've had Kevin O'Leary of Shark Tank. We had John Cleese, the British comedian, 2 years ago. We had Mike Rowe of Dirty Jobs last year. I mean, these are big names, and people love meeting with celebrities. And the other thing that's really cool about Freedom Fest, we have no green room. The speakers cannot hide. They're there as part of the conference. And a lot of them, I mean, you get to sit down with Steve Forbes. He actually attends the entire conference. All 3 days, he loves it because it's philosophy, it's history, it's science and technology. It's not just geopolitics and money, although we do have a 3-day investment conference. We have the Anthem Film Festival that my wife runs. People love the film festival to see first-run films before they get in the theaters. It's just a tremendous event. So this year, and we change our theme every year. So this year, it's July 12th. Or July 10th through the 13th in Las Vegas. We are at Caesars Forum. We were at the Mirage, but it's being rebuilt and turned into the Hard Rock Cafe. And while they're doing that, we're meeting at Caesars Forum, which is right, actually not in Caesars Palace, but across the, it's right behind Harrah's. So this year we have Steven Pinker, who is the public intellectual number one in my book. He's written a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature and Enlightenment Now. These are two books he's written, but his main thesis is that violence has been on the decline. And in fact, this year we celebrate 78 years where we've had no wars between any major powers. Yeah, we do have the war in Iraq. I mean, the war in Ukraine, and we've got the Middle East war that's going on. And that's going to be one of the topics that we're going to talk with Steven Pinker. Is this a reversal of the decline in violence? I think that will be an interesting topic. But we have, in addition to you coming back, and really the Tom Woods Show at Freedom Fest, I mean, that's exciting. And I hope everybody who's listening will take advantage of our early bird special, which is in place right now at just $397 per person, which is really cheap for today's conferences that cost close to $1,000 at most conferences these days. But anyway, we have Steve Forbes, we have John Mackey, the former CEO of Whole Foods, is coming, and he's with Alec Green, our financial expert, is debating the Bitcoin debate, which I think is always an interesting discussion of the future. We have Lisa Kennedy from Fox News as our MC extraordinaire. And I did want to mention one other speaker that we just confirmed, and we're very excited about him, and that's Ice-T. Ice-T is coming. He's the longest running actor on Law & Order and has an incredible career as a rapper, as a actor, and he's got a really clever Ice-T rap song called, Yes, Freedom of Speech, But Just Watch What You Say. So I'm very excited about having him. We don't have him on the Freedom Fest website yet, but he will be announced shortly, but we have confirmed him as a speaker. We also have Emily Pagano, I think is how you pronounce it, at Fox News as the outnumbered TV show that is really big. And we're also doing our minority libertarian and other parties. We're having a debate, a national political debate, not Trump, not Biden, but the minority candidates are all coming, including the libertarian candidates. So that'll be a really fun debate as well. The mock trial, we're putting social media on trial. I think that'll be a really interesting debate. Maybe we can get Mark Zuckerberg to come and defend social media. What do you think of that? So anyway, we're pretty excited about this year's Freedom Fest. We have hundreds of people already signed up. We'll have several thousand people there. It is, especially when you walk in that exhibit hall and feel the buzz, and our bookstore there and all the different financial and political groups. All our think tanks are there. Reason, Students for Liberty, Cato, Heritage, you know, everybody shows up. It's kind of the place to come together once a year if you want to meet everybody in the freedom movement.
So freedomfest.com is the website. Hey, everybody, last week I told you the story of Bad Luck Ichabod. Well, his woes continue, my friends. Poor Bad Luck Ichabod did have one thing going for him. He was smart enough to know to buy some gold. And in fact, he bought some gold along with some friends of his. They all bought the same amount. But then 2 years later, he met up with those friends again. And even though nobody had bought any more gold in the meantime, his friends somehow all had more gold than he did. How'd that happen? Well, poor Bad Luck Ichabod hadn't had the smarts to do what his friends had. Because like old Woods here, Bad Luck Ichabod's friends had opened an account with Monetary Metals. They'd been earning interest on their gold, paid in gold. What's the advantage of letting your gold just sit there, as Bad Luck Ichabod does, when you can be earning up to 5% in their gold leasing program or double-digit returns in their gold bonds if you're an accredited investor? It really is true. I put my money, my gold, where my mouth is, and opened an account with them myself, an account I've had for about 2 years now. It's time for you to do the same. Join me and our old friend Jeff Deist as we lead an honest money revolution that starts by opening an account at Monetary Metals today. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more. I don't want to finish this without making the clear connection between what we just talked about and business cycles. So what is the connection between the structure of production and the manipulation of interest rates, let's say by a central bank? What does that do to the structure of production that then leads to problems?
So this was really Hayek's and Mises' contribution to the business cycle, what is called the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And the basic argument is that you create imbalances in the economy, that when you lower interest rates, not every sector of the economy is affected in this equal amount, that some benefit more from lower interest rates than others. And consumer products, retail is not affected very much by interest rate changes. But mining and capital intensive companies and production can get extremely out of line and expand more rapidly. I'll go back to the example of the energy sector. So gasoline prices, when interest rates are low and gasoline and oil prices are rising, you see a huge boost in the exploratory and developmental energy companies. They may double or triple in value in the stock market. Refiners, on the other hand, are kind of halfway there. They benefit, but not a big way. But the final stage of production, the gasoline stage, you'll see gasoline prices go up, but nowhere near the increase that you see in the oil prices. So this is what creates imbalances, what we call imbalances in the economy in the boom phase. And then when the economy turns south, when they raise interest rates, that cuts off the capital markets and you see the boom turned into a bust. But the bust is not at the retail stage. The bust is in the production and the resource stage. So it's like a fan. If we were on a video, I could show you a fan of moving back and forth. And at your elbow is hardly moving at all, right? But your hand is moving back and forth. You can see me, but they can't. And
some people who are watching on video can see you.
Oh, they can.
Yeah. So, yeah. Not everybody does. Yeah.
I thought we were just audio.
Oh, good thing I forgot to tell you. I introduced video, but since I have trained my listeners to just listen to audio, yeah. I can't seem to transition them over here, but that's okay. Do what you want, people. Do whatever you want.
Well, you can see I'm wearing my Freedom Fest hat.
Yeah, I thought you were doing that on purpose.
Well, I am now. So, yeah, the fan is a really good way of showing how the economy engages in an imbalance type of situation. It's much more stable at the retail stage than it is at the resource and production stage. And that's where the business cycle really develops. And since 80% of employment is in the supply intermediate stages, you see the boom and the bust more in the earlier stages. And that's what's happening in the economy. And that's why we have recessions from time to time. A lot of people feel that this tight money policy that has been posed for the last year will finally result in a recession. We've seen a postponement in this recession, even in gross output statistics. The GO is also growing right now, 3-4%. And so why is that? Well, the reason is because interest rates affect only certain sectors of the economy more than others. And consumption is still doing very well. And the supply chain is actually doing surprisingly well. And one of the reasons for that is because I believe nobody talks about this, but cutting the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21% was a permanent change in the tax rate. It's not temporary like the rest of the Trump tax cut. This is a permanent reduction, and unless Congress changes it, it'll remain at 21%. I think that's very positive for companies coming back from overseas to produce more products and to keep their headquarters in the United States. So despite all the bad news out there regarding overregulation that the Biden administration has imposed, there are some positive factors that are working. The other difference is the supply chain shortages have just taken a long time to work themselves through the system, and we're gradually eliminating these shortages, and that's encouraging also. So while I think the recession is still quite possible in 2024 and 2025, it's been postponed largely because of these beneficial factors of the tax cuts.
I'm going to assume, and I don't, this is no insult is meant, but I just know the life cycle of academic books. Is it difficult to get a copy of The Structure of Production these days?
No, it's available in paperback through Amazon. It's published by NYU Press.
Oh, good. You can still get it. That's great.
Yeah, you can still get it. And then I also write about it quite a bit at grossoutput.com, my website. And I'm looking to write a book on gross output directly called Go Beyond GDP. And I'm looking for a publisher right now on that. So that's another, that'll be more of a book to the layman because as you indicate, the structure of production itself, the introductions I think are easy to understand. The book itself, it is for the intelligent layman, we could put it that way, but it is fairly technical in terms of the economics. Rick Rule of U.S. Sprott is a big fan of that book for people who want to know about how mining and energy and various stages of production concept. He recommends the book especially, but I do want to warn the readers that it is somewhat advanced, shall we say, in terms of economics.
Well, as I say, I'm quite fond of it, so I'll put a link to it in the description of the video, but also at tomwoods.com/2452. Well, let's raise a glass. I know you're LDS, Mark, so you can raise a glass of cranberry juice or whatever it is you like.
I've got some Schweppes club soda.
All right, we'll raise a club soda to old F.A. Hayek and his richly deserved Nobel Prize. I'm looking forward to seeing you at Freedom Fest, so check that out, freedomfest.com. Thank you so much, Mark.
My pleasure.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.